ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 18th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, dozens of schools across the country remain closed amid widening investigations into asbestos-tainted kids' play sand. And emotions high as one sporting great awards another one of the country's highest honours.
The winner of the Dawn Award from 2025 is no other than the great Lane Beachley.
To win an award in your honour is obviously incredibly overwhelming. And I love you very much.
The Victorian Liberals have elected a new leader, with first-term MP Jess Wilson becoming the first woman to lead the coalition in the state's history. In New South Wales, Liberal leader Mark Speakman is expected to face a challenge to his leadership later this week. And as those contests played out, leadership rumblings continue at a federal level. But Liberal leader Susan Lee vows she'll take her party to the next federal election. Here's Rachel Mealy.
Turning over a new leaf, again, the Victorian Liberal Party has chosen its third leader in 11 months.
This morning, the Liberal Party room elected me as parliamentary leader unopposed.
First-time MP Jess Wilson is the first woman to lead the Victorian Liberals in the party's history. With just 12 months until the state election, Victoria's newest opposition leader made her pitch to voters.
At the next election, 12 months from now, Victorians have a clear choice. A choice between a tired, out-of-touch Labor government or a new generation Liberal team. And as leader, I have a clear focus. I have clear priorities. One, to get the budget back into control so we can invest in things that matter. Two, to end the crime crisis. Three, to make sure that Victorians can get access to the healthcare that they need and deserve. And four, to give every Victorian the best opportunity to own their own home in this state.
Ousted leader Brad Batten says he looks forward to fighting for the team at the next election.
As a very proud member of the Victorian Liberal Party, I stand continuously proud in the role that I've done and the things that I've done for the community.
Jess Wilson takes the reins of a party that's been in opposition for more than a decade. Despite the growing unpopularity of Victoria's Labor Premier Jacinta Allen, polling in recent months shows the coalition's standing with voters isn't improving. Tony Barry is a former Liberal strategist and director of the Redbridge Group, a political research and strategy firm.
I think she represents change, and the electorate are desperate for change right now.
North of the Murray River, a similar challenge looks set to play out later in the week in the New South Wales Liberal Party, where opposition leader Mark Speakman may face a challenge from Vaucluse MP Kelly Sloan. Alexandra Smith is the state political editor for the Sydney Morning Herald.
The concern is that Premier Chris Minns has been quite effective in getting his messaging out, and Mark Speakman perhaps less so in being able to get a Liberal narrative and what they want to do going into the next election, as well as, landing any blows, so to speak, on Chris Minns.
She says with a state election scheduled for March 2027, the members of the New South Wales Liberal Party room may decide that Kelly Sloan would be better in a head-to-head contest with the Premier.
So Kelly is seen as, I guess, the next generation. She would be a very different sort of leader to Mark Speakman, and I think many Liberal MPs think it would just be the reset that they need to take them into March 27.
At the federal level, Liberal leader Susan Lee has vowed she'll take her party to the next election.
I am the leader and was elected 6 months ago. We've been working on policy ever since.
Despite acquiescing to her party's conservative flank to drop the net zero target from its climate policy, Susan Lee hopes her party has moved on from internal debate and is now focusing on the future.
Well, now I acknowledge when it appears that we're talking about ourselves, people do mark us down. I accept that. But I'm also thrilled to say that both our party rooms came together, and as leader of the opposition, that's an exercise that I led after 6 months of policy development, and agreed on this plan, which is about something that matters much more to Australians than the Canberra bubble speculation.
The opposition leader Susan Lee there, ending that report by Rachel Mealy. While the Federal Liberal Party continues its policy soul search, a new poll has found Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party is the party voters most trust to handle the issue of immigration. It's an economic and population issue being tackled across the West. In the UK, the British government announced new plans to overhaul aspects of their country's immigration system, taking inspiration from Denmark, which has some of the toughest policies on the continent. Nicole Johnston has the story.
I will make a statement about how we restore order and control to our borders.
British Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood announcing the most significant changes to the UK's migration policy since the end of World War II.
We must also acknowledge that the world has changed and our asylum system has not changed with it.
Carla Denyer.
She's an MP from the Greens Party in Bristol.
Madam Deputy Speaker, it isn't people seeking sanctuary that are tearing our country apart. It's toxic, racist narratives and the scapegoating of migrants and asylum seekers for what is nothing to do with them. The chronic housing crisis, the running down of public services are not caused by migrants.
Under the changes, the British Labour government wants to increase the time it takes to receive permanent settlement from 5 years to 20. A poll last week found immigration is the most important issue for British voters, and politicians are paying attention. In Australia too, the coalition says its next big issue is migration. And a recent poll commissioned by the Australian Financial Review has found Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party is the party voters most trust to handle the issue. Pauline Hanson.
I want to see a country that's not divided with different views or different cultures, different laws, and I will stand my ground there. I've seen this happen in other countries around the world, especially in England now, the division that's happening there.
In Europe, an anti-migration wave is rippling through the continent. Experts say the UK's new asylum policy is modelled on Denmark. For a decade, this Nordic country has been introducing Europe's toughest refugee laws. Michelle Page is professor in global studies at Roskilde University in Denmark. Has this policy succeeded, though, in dropping asylum claims into Denmark?
Yes. In terms of numbers, if you just want to look at numbers, it's been successful. But of course, it comes at a huge human cost. It comes at a huge reputational cost.
Does the Danish public support these policies?
So Denmark is divided on this in terms of public sentiment. And I think it depends a bit where you are located. If you are in the major cities of Copenhagen, for instance, where you live diversity every day, you have no problem with diversity and multiculturalism. But if you live in the island of Fyn, for instance, where you hardly see anyone who's non-white, then you can take the Danish People's Party's rhetoric and you don't question it.
In the UK, people are questioning. Inside the Labour camp, some are calling it racist, while the Conservative Party wants an even tougher approach. Immigration, an issue that's dividing politicians, parties,
stop the vote! Send them on!
And the public.
Nicole Johnston reporting. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. The ousted Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, has been sentenced to death for a bloody crackdown on anti-government protesters last year that killed an estimated 1,400 people. The student-led uprising toppled her government and forced the long-running leader to flee to India. Today, Bangladesh's International Crimes Tribunal found Sheikh Hasina guilty of crimes against humanity, the harshest sentence ever handed to one of the country's leaders. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
Multiple convictions, a single sentence.
For all these three counts, we have decided to inflict her with only one sentence, that is sentence of death.
Bangladesh's deposed Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina sentenced to death for crimes against humanity. In and outside the courtroom, large crowds celebrated the verdict. There were prayers, cheers, and clashes with police as protesters attempted to demolish Hasina's father's house with an excavator. But the former leader was nowhere to be seen. Throughout the months-long trial, Hasina has been in exile in India. Last year, thousands of Bangladeshis were killed and injured during student-led protests in the country, following orders from Hasina for a bloody crackdown. Bangladesh's International Crimes Tribunal has found her and one of her closest aides guilty of incitement, ordering killings, and failing to prevent atrocities during the uprising. Tajul Islam is the chief prosecutor.
The accused Sheikh Hasina has been found guilty of crimes against humanity for killing around 1,400 students and civilians and injuring about 25,000 during the July 2024 uprising in Bangladesh.
From India, Hasina issued a written statement dismissing the ruling as coming from a, quote, rigged tribunal. It's a claim the interim government has rejected, a spokesperson saying the tribunal has functioned transparently. The UN, which decried the deadly crackdown as the worst political violence in Bangladesh since the 1971 War of Independence, has also condemned the death penalty. But for victims, families and many Bangladeshis, the verdict is providing some relief.
My son went out on August 5th, 2024 to take photographs of the conflict. My Miraz was hit in his chest with several bullets and he died on the spot. We take the Almighty's gratitude seeing the verdict of the murderer Hasina today.
I think this is the first step in bringing justice to the families of the martyrs.
Those who did wrong must suffer consequences. That's what we prefer as citizens.
Following through on execution orders is, however, a different story. That's because India is showing no signs of sending Hasina back.
Unless that extradition can happen, I don't think that this sentence can ever be carried out.
That's Bangladeshi journalist Zaima Islam.
The death penalty has been abolished in most modern states. So Bangladesh is not going to be finding many friends who will help Bangladesh bring back Hasina.
Regardless of the outcome, Western Sydney University's Dr. Mubasha Hassan, who was also held captive in Bangladesh in 2017 under Hasina's rule, says it's a historic moment.
Even though she is in India at the moment, it asserts a significance and a political milestone that underpins that no one is above the law.
Western Sydney University's Dr. Mubasha Hassan, ending that report by Julia Bergen. Schools and childcare centres in Australia and New Zealand are going through the lengthy and delicate process of removing coloured play sand products after trace amounts of asbestos were discovered. In all, authorities have closed or confirmed that 34 schools across the country remain closed today. With several coloured sand products recalled, parents and those within the sector are questioning how the products were allowed into Australia and are calling for tighter mandatory national safety standards. Here's Kimberly Price.
Liani Joubert's son requires round-the-clock support and regularly uses coloured sand in his Canberra classroom. His mum was alarmed to learn the sensory toy could have traces of asbestos in it.
It's a little frightening how much of exposure. It's hard to tell. They don't always participate in the activities as planned, so it depends from child to child.
Liani Joubert believes there needs to be higher safety standards on children's toys.
So I think the accountability sits with the distributors to make sure that if there's any changes in suppliers or any changes in recipes or ingredients within the products that they distribute, that they are responsible to make sure that it still complies with safety regulations.
Rosie Thomas is the director of campaigns at consumer advocacy group Choice and says there are mandatory safety standards in place in Australia.
The responsibility for those standards sits with the online third-party sellers in this case when we're talking about online marketplaces. Now, those on third-party sellers could be small offshore businesses that don't really care too much about their reputation or compliance in Australia. And so that means our regulators and authorities have limited tools in terms of enforcing the law against them.
She says Choice is advocating for stronger product safety laws.
Laws that would make sure that all businesses, including the online marketplaces, were required to ensure products are safe before they sell them.
Multiple products have now been recalled, including Magic Sand sold at Kmart and Target, 6 packs of decorative sand tubes sold at Officeworks, and the larger 1 to 1.3 kilogram tubs of coloured sand. Authorities have responded differently from state to state, with the Queensland government refusing to confirm how many schools have been using the sand. The ACT is the worst affected, with 25 public schools remaining closed today, down from 69 yesterday. Two specialist schools in South Australia have closed for deep cleaning, but nearly 300 schools in the state have the sand. Blair Boyer is the South Australian Education Minister and supports the idea of tougher national safety standards.
I hope that what we have learnt here from this case is that some work is done by the federal government to look at how it got in and what we can actually do to make sure that it doesn't get in again in the future.
University of Technology Sydney Professor Brian Oliver says the exact amount of asbestos in the coloured sand is unconfirmed.
But from Safe Work ACT, they said that there's a small amount of asbestos, so almost trace amounts of asbestos in there.
And he believes the asbestos exposure threat to children is low.
If that was sand like you might find on the beach and you could throw it up in the air and aerosolise it, there may be a bit more of a risk. But my understanding is that sand is the sort of sand that clumps together, a little bit like Play-Doh.
Each state has different disposal guidelines. The head of the Asbestos Disease Society of Australia, Melita Markey, says that's a concern.
The Federal Asbestos Eradication Agency came out with a strategic plan. Not every state signed on to that immediately, and then they could pick or choose what parts they adopted.
Asbestos Disease Society of Australia CEO Melita Markey, ending that report by Kimberly Price and Luke Radford. There was a time when you couldn't turn on the TV or the radio or open a newspaper without catching slogans like these.
So if you're driving, think OO and go with the double O.
If you drink, then drive. You're a bloody idiot.
Drive. What's your plan B?
Unfortunately, the passenger from the other vehicle has died.
Yeah, no, I'll get a ride, hon.
I'll never be able to walk unaided again.
If you drink, then drive. You're a bloody idiot.
And it looks like those ad campaigns worked. Drink driving fatalities have been falling since 2020. But now there are more fatal crashes involving drugs than alcohol. Associate Professor Milad Haghani is Principal Fellow in Urban Risk and Resilience at the University of Melbourne. I spoke to him earlier. Professor, the share of fatalities involving illegal blood alcohol concentration has really fallen steadily from about 30% to 14% between 2008 and 2023. Why do you think drink driving fatalities have fallen by so much?
That is absolutely the case. In fact, the story of Australia curbing drink driving is a story of success. As you mentioned, the percentage of fatalities involving drink driving has been steadily on the decline, and that is thanks to a combination of factors. First of all, we have a very extensive random breath testing program. We have more than 10 million random breath tests conducted nationally every year, and that has been a big deterrent for drivers to get on the road while under the influence of alcohol, because the chances are that they get caught. At the same time, we have had very successful behavioral and educational campaigns that has significantly shifted the culture. And at the moment, it is quite a taboo to get on the road while drunk. There is peer pressure, family pressure, and you basically don't get away with it easily. So that is something that has contributed to building a culture that regards drink driving as a big taboo. But the same thing has not necessarily happened with drug driving.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that there are new data sets that show that there are more fatal crashes involving drugs and alcohol. There are obviously a few different factors at play here. What are they?
Fatal crashes involving drugs right now, the biggest risk factor in fatal crashes above anything else, including not wearing seatbelt and drink driving. Some of the factors that are contributing to this is the fact that we do have roadside drug testing. However, the scale of the testing is so limited compared to random breath testing that the likelihood of a driver getting caught is very small, and drivers know that as well. So the exposure to this random drug testing for drivers is not high enough to become a deterrent. And at the same time, there is this misperception on the parts of many people who would think that, well, the type of drug that I use actually makes me more mentally aware, and it's not going to be detrimental to my drive, or the dosage that I use is so small that it's not going to have an effect. Everybody agreed that drink driving is going to be bad, but not necessarily the same perceptions are being held in relation to drug driving.
So for road safety experts and authorities around Australia, it's kind of back to the drawing board in the same way that drink driving campaigns were born in the 80s and 90s. How are states and territories planning to tackle this? Is it the same as drink driving or a different kind of behavioural technique?
Well, I think it's going to require some to adopt some lessons that we've had from drink driving campaigns, but also tailoring that to the concept of drug driving, especially targeting the misconceptions that exist around drug driving. The literature does show that all sorts of drugs, illicit drugs, do have an impact on the ability of the driver. So this has to be communicated. The science behind it needs to be communicated. And at the same time, I think that the deterrence factor needs to be amplified. And I understand that testing for drugs is much more expensive compared to a random breath test, and it can never be probably scaled up to the level that we have for random breath testing. However, having the exposure of the drivers, having the drug boss out there would be a deterrent for people to know that there are chances that they get exposed to testing and get caught.
Associate Professor Milad Haghani, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
She's a household name who paved the way for women and went on to win 7 World Surfing Championships. Lane Beachley has been awarded the prestigious Dawn Award at the Sport Australia Hall of Fame Gala. It's one of the country's highest honours in sport, named after swimmer Dawn Fraser. Tanya Dendrinos has the story.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to announce the winner of the Dawn Award for 2025.
Announced by Dawn Fraser herself.
Is no other than the great Lane Beachley.
It was a moment of shared pride for two women who helped pave the way in women's sport.
To win an award in your honour is obviously incredibly overwhelming. And I love you very much.
Lane Beachley was inducted into the Sport Australia Hall of Fame in 2011 as an athlete member, and 2 years ago was elevated to legend status, recognising her invaluable contribution to the world of surfing. Now comes the addition of the Dawn Award for her courage, resilience and determination.
Congratulations. Did you think that this would ever happen?
Never. It's a dream come true.
The 7-time world champion surfer challenged the status quo in the world of surfing.
The new world champion, or 2nd-time world champion in a row, Lane Beachley of Australia.
And transformed it for women the world over.
1993 was the first event I ever won, and I won the last event in 2006 when I won my last world title. And every single trophy has either an image or a sculpture of a man in every single one of them. So I reflect back on my career and I reflect back on the misogyny and the sexism and the challenges and the threats and the intimidation that we overcame. And I think one of the things that I'm really proud of is that I had the courage to speak up and I was brave enough to challenge the status quo and overthrow a lot of that. And that's what really motivates me to continue paving the way.
She fought hard for pay equity, which was achieved in 2018, a feat not lost on the generation who came after her, including pro surfer Sally Fitzgibbons.
I totally just grew up idolising Lane, Lano as I called it, and yeah, far out, it was just this icon status.
The former world number one says Lane Beachley's impact on the sport is immeasurable.
All my teachers, like, you know, when I told them that I was going to go travel the world and chase this surfing dream, they were like, oh my gosh, you better have a backup plan. Like, that does not sound like a secure livelihood that you're aiming for. And I just remember at the time, you know, Lane started up her Aim for the Stars Foundation, and she was always, you know, teaching us to aim for those stars. And she was one of very few that was committing that money straight back into our development, and receiving a scholarship from Lane at that time was just like, nah, this is totally possible.
Sally Fitzgibbon says the Dawn Award offers Lane Beachley an opportunity to reflect on her achievements.
For her receiving these awards, it really does like continue to remind her to look back and, you know, stand on top of the mountain she's climbed and just appreciate it for a second, because I know they were just continually driving and looking for that improvement and growth in themselves and in the sport.
And she has one special message for the woman who continues to inspire so many.
Lena, you're amongst the stars and just enjoy the view because you've paved this road and we're all walking it.
Pro surfer Sally Fitzgibbons, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As you would have seen, the Liberals and Nationals have now officially dumped net zero emission targets from their climate and energy policy. It keeps the coalition together. But what do voters think? Today, pollster, former Labor strategist and director of the Redbridge Group, Cos Samaras, on whether it's a winning strategy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.